Okay.
Thank you.
Good
afternoon. We discuss an agenda paper 5A or memo number 15A. Last month, you had an ed session on collateral. You had representatives from ISDA and a clearinghouse to talk to you about the different kinds of collateral treatments in practice today. You also had a joint session, and you discussed with the staff the various types of collateral, the issue of units of account, and also papers that you want us to bring to you today. Following the request that you made, the staff has prepared a series of papers addressing different issues. Paper 5A and the appendices discuss the alternatives that are before the boards. There are three alternatives that today we'll be talking to you about. The first one is the conditional approach. Then you have a kind of a hybrid approach, I will call it. And then there's a third approach, which is more a conditional approach. We have three other papers, paper 5B, C, and D. They are only relevant if you decide to pursue alternative one. So to the extent that you decide to pursue alternative one tomorrow, we'll be back here discussing those papers with you. But should you decide not to pursue alternative one, we'll throw those papers away.
And you want alternative one, and that's the selling for it, is it?
Yeah. we think each of the products have got their merits, so we'll see today.
It should be alternative two as well, right? Sure.
we like coming back to the board. Today we'll be discussing Agenda Paper 5A, 15A, and the three appendices. These are three alternatives that the boards can pursue, but I just want to clarify that in the papers we do refer to gross presentation a lot. Neither of the three alternatives is a gross approach, because whichever approach you pursue, you have some offsetting. It's a question of how much offsetting that you do and the basis for getting that offset. Alternative one is the ED approach revised to take into account comments that respondents made, in particular the issue of units of account and also simultaneous settlement, and the third one being collateral. Under the ED, there was a prohibition that you cannot offset collateral against the asset and the liability, and we're making a recommendation as to which type of collateral you can take into account. Alternative number two is the IS-32 approach. It is one interpretation, I would say, of the IS-32 approach. Today, some interpret IS-32 to mean that you need to have a right of offset that is currently enforceable. Today, you can enforce it. You don't need to look at what will happen in bankruptcy. So if you look at the three alternatives, the difference is that the ED approach says you need to have that right today and at all times. Whereas the IS-32, at least that interpretation of IS-32, says that you need to have the right to offset today. The U.S. GAAP approach, which is alternative three, looks at what you can do solely in bankruptcy. There is a variation of alternative three, which is 3A. And I might say that three is actually an exception to the general concept. So if you agree today that you're going to pursue alternative one for all other products, but for derivatives you want to make an exception, then 3A and 3 will come into effect. How you can make that exception to make it workable. So these are the three alternatives that we have. We try to apply the models to some types of transactions and instruments just to give you a flavor of where more or less the line is being drawn. We know that it's not the basis for you to make a decision, but so we think it will be helpful to at least have a feel for where you're landing, more or less. So there's a sheet that was distributed, and if I just want to spend about 5 minutes on that before we ask you the key question. So these are about 10 different transactions or instruments that we try to apply the models to. The first one is you have a group of financial instruments, and each of them comprise of a single cash flow. So there's only one payment for those instruments. And they're all settling on the same date. And the entity has got a right to set off both in normal course and in bankruptcy. But there's no variation margin. Here, the entity can demonstrate an intention to settle net. And hence, if you look at the chart, you'll get offset under almost all the approaches, except where you're doing a pure gross approach where you don't allow any kind of offset. The only caveat I'll put here is that many times when your payment net, you know, a right to offset in normal course and also in bankruptcy, you might be able to do it only by currency. So to the extent that the payments are due in the same currency, you'll be allowed to offset those payments and pay a net amount. So it might mean that you end up with different buckets, different currency buckets for offset. In scenario number two, it's the same as scenario number one, but here the instruments are settling on different dates. And because they are settling on different dates, the entity cannot demonstrate an intent to settle net. And hence, there will not be any offset under alternative one and two, because you need to have an intention to either settle net or simultaneously. Under alternative 3A as well, you will not get, because 3A is an exception to 1, and 3 is also an exception to 1, so you will not get offset. And scenario 3 is the same as scenario number 1, except that the right of offset is only exercisable in the normal course of business, i.e. you cannot settle net in bankruptcy. Because you cannot do that in bankruptcy, you will fail under alternative 1, but alternative 2 looks to only what you can do in normal course of business, and hence you will get offset under alternative 2. But you will not get offset under alternative 3A and 3. So moving on to scenario number 4, is the same as scenario number 1, we're just making changing different parts of it just to test the models. Here you do have a right to offset off, but it's only exercisable in bankruptcy, and hence you cannot demonstrate an intention to settle net, so you will not get offsets except under alternative 3. Alternative 3 looks to what you can do in bankruptcy, so in this particular case you get offsets under alternative 3. Scenario number 5 is the same as scenario number 1, but here the entity has entered into two offsetting trades. And I think it's one of the issues that came up when respondents' comments came back, that when you do a gross presentation and an entity has entered into an offsetting trade, you're still not allowing that economic picture to be demonstrated on the face of the balance sheet. But here, as you can see, if you've entered into an offsetting trade, the trades will match, or the payments and the legs will match, and hence you will get offset under all the approaches, except where you're doing a pure gross approach. Alternative number 6 is the same as scenario 1, except that here you have financial instruments that have multiple cash flows, but the cash flows are not coinciding. I've jumped one, I think. I think it's scenario number 5. Sorry, let's go back to scenario number 5. It's the same as scenario number 1, but here the reporting entity has got an offsetting trade and the cash flows will coincide, the one that I just went through. So scenario number 6, the cash flows will not coincide. So one will be paying monthly, the other will be paying quarterly or daily, so different payment dates. So the entity cannot demonstrate an intention to settle net because the payment dates are different. So you cannot say, I'm going to settle net. And hence, you will not get offset under any of the approaches except in alternative number 3. Moving on to scenario number 7, is the same as 6, i.e. multiple cash flows, non-coinciding payment dates. But here you have a variation margin scheme. But the scheme works in such a way that you settle the underlying contracts separately from the variation margin. The two are not netted, so you do it separately. And because it's separate, you cannot demonstrate an intention to settle net. And you have, under alternative 1, you have the settlement risk and the credit risk and the rest of it. And hence, you will not get offset under alternative 1, alternative 2, but you will get offset under alternative 3A and alternative number 3. Last but one is, I think, scenario number 8, where you have a specific type of variation margin scheme where you combine the settlement of the underlying contracts and the variation margin. So you net them and you pay a single sum each day. Because you have that scenario, you meet the principle under the offset and ED, and hence you get offset under alternative 1, 2, and all the approaches, actually. But moving on to number 9, which is very typical for repos and reverse repos. You're settling simultaneously. No, you're not settling net. you do have the intention to settle simultaneously, and you do have the right to do so. Under all the approaches, you will get offset. The last one is where you have no right of offset, and we just wanted to test how the approaches will work. You will not get offset under any of the approaches, except where you're doing a pure net approach, i.e. it doesn't matter whether you have a right of offset or not. To the extent that you have a trade with a counterparty, multiple trades with the same counterparty, you're allowed to present it net. So these are the extremes. You have a pure gross approach and a pure net approach. None of the alternatives before you today is a net approach or a gross approach. They are just a variation. You allow some offset, but the question is, on what basis are you going to allow the offset, and how much of the offset will occur in practice if you take that particular approach? On that basis, well, I will allow for questions. I'll invite questions, I'll say. I will invite questions, and then we can go to the question that we have for you. Sorry.
Can I have a question? So,
you're allowed.
In case of eight, the same as scenario six. So scenario six, it seems to me that B is a no intention to settle net. So that means two criteria is intention part is not met. But in case of eight, it's overridden by this kind of variation margin system?
Yeah. Where you have a single variation margin system in place, it works in such a way that you can demonstrate an intention to settle nets on a daily basis. Because all the variations, all the changes in fair value, together with the settlement of the underlying contracts, will go together. So there is no... To some extent, you cannot see the difference between the settlement of the underlying contracts and the variation margin. They all merge together. And they happen on a daily basis. And they settle a net amount on a daily basis. And hence, you can demonstrate an intention to settle a net.
This is kind of jumping ahead, because this alternative assumes that we've gone through the subsequent board papers about collateral and margin, and that we've agreed that these types of scenarios meet the intention to settle net. So when we did alternative one, we assumed that what we recommended in those papers were accepted so that we could show different examples.
Yeah, but just the point is my intention is overridden by the sort of the settlement mechanism. That is the indication.
I think the settlement mechanism actually demonstrates your intention.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
By the way it works, it demonstrates your intention to settle net.
You do have an intention.
So there's some
My point is that you said that based on scenario six, mm-hmm. scenario six B says no intention to settle net. So it troubles me a lot.
I think you're so right to say.
You are wrong.
Yeah. I think you're right to say that we should have put a phrase in there to say that there is an intention to settle net. That will have to resolve your point here.
Sorry.
No. Any other questions? Okay, keep going, Christian.
Okay, I think the arguments are quite detailed. We wrote very lengthy papers just to give you the benefit of the pros and cons of the various alternatives. We do not intend to go through all the individual reasons why a particular approach is better or one is not as strong as the other. So we want to just launch straight ahead and ask you the critical question. Is that which of these three alternatives would you want to pursue? Is the alternative one, which is based on an intention and a right of offset that is enforceable both in normal course of business and in bankruptcy, or alternative two, that you look to only what you can do today and disregard what will happen in bankruptcy? Or you do alternative three, which would be an exception to whatever core model that you would develop, and you look to what you can do in bankruptcy for derivatives and some types of either collateralized or non-collateralized. So that's a question that we have for you so that we can go away and finish all the projects, so to speak. So the question for the board is which of these alternatives, alternative one to three, would you want the staff to pursue, or would you want to pursue so the staff will work on it for you?
Okay, are they... 22 of us, so if you're going to make a speech, could you keep it very short or I'll cut you off, okay? We have to watch the time. Steve. Right, time up.
I'm interested in 1 and 3A, and the only difference between 1 and 3A is your scenario 7.
Yeah.
Can you just elaborate on how frequent that is and what is the difference between those two alternatives?
The difference is the issue that we tried to illustrate at the last session, where let's assume today you have an asset of 100 and a liability of 70. The liability matures tomorrow. The asset matures in a year's time, taking a very extreme example. And because your difference is 30, you've called for variation margin of 30. So one can argue that your exposure is zero because you've called for a variation margin of 30. But what will happen is that because the liability is due tomorrow, you'll pay out the 70 tomorrow, and you wait for the counterparty to give you a variation margin of 70 back the next day, or however long it will take. So you settle the underlying contract separately from the call of the variation margin. So once you pay the 70, if your counterparty goes bankrupt, by representing that your exposure was nil, was misleading, because now your counterparty cannot give you back the variation margin. Whereas if you combine the two processes in two payments in one process, what will happen is that you not give the 70 to the counterparty. You will say that, well, if I give you 70, I have to call back 70 tomorrow. So I'm not giving you the 70 today. And hence, when you say your exposure is nil, it always continues to be nil, except where there's change in fair value. Okay. Then you have to wait for the next.
So the difference is quite significant, because 7 and 8 are both central clearing parties, but they just operate differently. I thought maybe 7 was over the counter and 8 was exchanges, but these 7 and 8 is different types of exchanges.
Not necessarily. You can replicate that in the OTC world. And
sure,
at the last meeting, some of the ISO members said they're trying to push to more single process, but okay, Not everybody's there yet.
So at the moment, there's a big difference between 1 and 3A, but that difference might decline in the future as exchanges change.
That's correct. Yeah,
Ali, you want to come in?
Yes, thank you. I was just going to point out that under Alternative 3A, it was simply to focus on the fact that there are similarities in how OTC bilateral trades settle versus what's settled through a central clearing party. And I would just want to say that the overnight risk that Christian depicted in his example would be reflected in the balance sheet. That net exposure risk would be reflected under alternative one, maybe the process settles the collateral on the same day, but your net exposure, that overnight exposure, would be reflected in the net amount under alternative 3A.
I think I'll beg to disagree with my colleague. In the example that I just illustrated for you, the two are not the same. So I take a very simple example too. When you have an asset of 100 maturing in a year's time and a liability of 70 maturing tomorrow, the two will give you different. If you represent today that your exposure is zero because you have collateral of 30 against an asset of 100, liability of 70, and hence your exposure is nil, that is not truly the case, because tomorrow what will happen is that you pay out on the 70 and you have to wait for the counterparty to give you a variation margin of 70. So the assertion that the two are the same is not. I would disagree with my colleague.
I think all Holly's saying is if the balance sheet date is the day in which you paid the 70, your balance sheet date will reflect that $70 obligation.
And if it's not,
No, I think it depends on when you cut the balance sheet. So let's say you do the balance sheet today that you have collateral of 30 now. So if you add the three legs together, you say you have an exposure of zero. So you net all the three amounts together, you say zero. But the very next day, you pay out on the 70. So by telling all your creditors and everybody, all your shareholders and all the users of the financial statements that your exposure is zero, it's misleading, because the very next day, nothing has changed, no fair value movements, just the payment, the settlement of the underlying contracts is triggering a huge difference between the two approaches. That's what I'm trying to say. So the two are not the same. And in fact, there are some exchanges that work on that model. If you take our LCH, which is the major swap counterparty globally, that's the way they settle their swap contracts. majority of the swap contracts settled through LCH, and they do the single process because of this particular problem. So some people do it, others are not doing it, but they are moving in that direction. So the two are not the same.
So in your example, even though it comes to net on the day, you would actually show asset, liability, and collateral?
If it's a different two, you have two different processes, then you will show the asset of either 100 or the asset minus the collateral of 30, 70 position, and a 70 liability. Because you're going to settle the two separately, and hence you need to reflect that separately.
That's alternative one.
That's alternative one, yeah.
Not 3A. Yeah.
Not 3A, yeah.
It's a 30s on condition.
3A would net them.
Yes.
Yeah.
Would net them, but once you paid one leg, you do not net under 3. That was Holly's point. Once you paid one leg for that overnight exposure, if that's your balance sheet date, you depict it. If that's not your balance sheet date, all proponents of 3 don't think you have that exposure. Proponents of 1 think you do.
I think the issue is about when you draw the balance sheet and what message are you conveying with the balance sheet.
Right. Right.
And hence we're saying, well, depending on when you draw your balance sheet, you'll be telling a different story from what is going to happen in reality. And hence it's not an approach that will always give you I'll say the true information or a true picture of the financial position of an entity. And hence, we run the risk of a situation where one party pays. And at the last session, we demonstrated a case where it's happened many times with the Head Start risk, Drexel, and a few Barings and the rest of them. You pay on one hand, you wait for your counterparty to pay you tomorrow, your counterparty goes bankrupt. And so you've been telling your shareholders and the users of the financial statements that my exposure is a net amount, but that's not the case. Because that's not what's going to happen tomorrow.
Okay. Does the initial margin provide some insurance, and that you could count here, or take some those who might support 3A get some comfort out of the initial margin, or the pool? I forget what the third type of margin.
Yeah, I think it goes to some extent to mitigate any exposure you have, but the calculation of the initial margin is not based on the settlement of the underlying contracts. It's based on the potential movements in the value of the contracts that you have. And hence, depending on the amount you're settling on a daily basis, it can be the same, it can be more, it can be less. Okay. It's difficult to tell.
Good question, Steve. Other questions, points?
Thank you,
sir. Right, Russ.
Chris and I are just going to have to agree to disagree. I'm a view 3 proponent, although I can accept 3A. I believe that at the balance sheet date, if you are protected in bankruptcy, you should reflect that net, and the footnote should show what your gross exposure. That's what I put in the alternative view. I continue to believe that. I think 3A, I can live with it, but I think what we will cause, and maybe this is a good thing, although I'm not sure standard setters should cause change in behavioral practices, I think 3A will result in more posting of collateral. To me, if I'm running an economic, look at the economics, if I don't require collateral, I think my view is that the other party is fairly creditworthy. So I don't think I need to have the posting of collateral. But if we require that to get to netting, which is what 3A in essence is doing, I think what the result will be is those arrangements where there is not a requirement for collateral today will just require collateral tomorrow, and so be it. But I would prefer 3, but I can accept 3A. I cannot accept 1 or 2.
Okay, thanks, Russ. Other comments?
On that point, Christian, would I be right in saying, though, that if you purely just post collateral, then all that set off does is allows you to now set off the asset you've got against the collateral you've posted?
Because if you've
got an asset and a liability, and what you've actually done to resolve the problem is decided to net settle them, that will allow you set off. But if you're saying that you've got an asset and liability and now you've posted collateral, well, now you've got another asset or another liability, probably another asset. And now all that you really get out of that in addition is the ability to offset that collateral against the asset or liability.
As I understand, 3A says take the net position and then net that against the posting of collateral. So 3A, and In a situation where you have posting collateral, 3A and 3 get you the same answer. But if you don't post collateral, you get a different answer between 3, which would net, and 3A, which would require the entire thing to be gross.
I think that there are many, there's a point you made, Russ, and I think I just wanted to ask you a question on that. So you're saying that entities are going to change their risk management and the way they do their business just because the accounting guidance has changed and they want netting, so they're going to change the way they risk manage and the way they manage their business just because of change in accounting. Because that's what you imply by what you said. And the other bit I wanted to touch on is that most of these collateral items that you have, you're not allowed to offset them against the positions that you have. You're just holding them as a credit mitigating tool. You're not going to use them to settle the underlying contracts. If your counterparty defaults, just like when you lend money, you borrow money today to buy a house, it is conditioned on you paying the underlying loan. So what is the difference between a situation where I borrowed to buy a house, I even have a non-recourse loan on a house that I bought, and the counterparty can take the house when I default? It is more or less the same. I put the collateral for it. So why should that be different from the derivative situation?
Right, okay, so thank you.
You're
welcome. Yeah. So say according to this, alternative 3A is it said there is a daily posting of cash collaterals. So that means the mechanism itself is a sort of the daily settlement, or just the posting is still the status is a collateral, not the partial settlement.
Yeah, I think there are two issues. One is that the party that is giving the money to you or whatever asset is posting as collateral, he has got a right to ask you to give it back to him if he fulfills his obligations in the underlying contracts. So if he continues to pay, you have to give the cash or the asset back to him. That's the first point. The second one is that the changes in fair value of the portfolio of instruments you have between you and the counterparty will be driven by two things. One is the settlement of the underlying contracts, and then there's changes in fair value. And that's the reason why I said when you have the 70 and the 100, as soon as you pay out on the 70, the value of the portfolio as a whole has gone down. And hence, you need to ask for more variation margin. And because you're keeping the two separately, you could pay out a lot. And you could pay as much as the bank's entire capital can be paid out in a day. And then you have to wait the next day to be recompensed or to be given variation margin back. And you run a huge risk if you do that.
Clarify one point that I think you made, Russ. Holly, correct me if I'm wrong. Sorry. I wanted to just clarify, because you had mentioned that if you have collateral posted, it would be the same in 3 and 3A. And I think there is a difference, because I think 3A is a little bit stricter. So say you have netting, you know, standard master netting agreement, and you post collateral maybe once a month. I think 3A is saying there has to be a daily variation.
No, I agree.
I just wanted to make that clarification.
You challenged me, which is fair. Right now today, suppose Tom and I have a master netting agreement, but I think Tom, you know, he seems gainfully employed. I'm not going to require him to post daily collateral. And so Tom has done the same judgment with me, his bad judgment. We don't need to post collateral. And so we're happy with net. Our users are happy with net. Now, in order to go to 3A, we're just going to sign an agreement that says, okay, Tom and Russ will post 10% daily collateral. Neither of us need it for a credit mitigating strategy, but you're going to require, if you go to 3A, you're going to require it to be done to achieve an accounting result. And I just, that's the point where that's why I prefer 3 over 3A, but I can live with 3A. That was the point I was making.
Okay, Holly, did you want to come in?
Yes, I just wanted to say that, 3A was developed to focus on the risk that Christian was describing, the Herstatt risk that has been referenced in multiple papers that you've seen. Just so everyone's clear, when he makes comments about the leverage of the entity, it could wipe out a company's capital, that the original Herstatt incident did relate to an FX currency swap where large notional balances, because of the nature of the derivative, were swapping on day one. And in that particular instance, the amounts had been received by the Herstatt entity, and the amounts that were supposed to be paid out had not made their way out before it filed for bankruptcy. So as a result of that incident, they created the CLS Bank, which is also referenced in the memo, and that is served to deal with settlement risk as it relates to FX derivative transactions. Settlement risk is, in general, just a percentage of the gross amounts that you're dealing with on a normal basis. And so I think if you take FX off the table because of the creation and the use of CLS Bank, I just don't think that the risk is as significant as Christian has described. So it's just a difference of opinion on that.
It's interesting. I just wanted to make a point. I'm not going to argue that, but I just, for the benefit of the board, just recently in the Lehman case, a German bank made a payment out to Lehman Brothers and is still waiting for the money to be given to them. So it is not something that happens infrequently. It's not only an FX problem. It's a general problem. So I just wanted to clarify that.
Okay. I've got John, Tom, Leslie, Larry. John.
I'm alternative one. When we voted on this, I voted against, or I voted for, I'd say, the master netting. It was acceptable to me, I'll put it that way, although I didn't provide an alternative view on that. And when I read this, I have difficulty really saying which is better. I mean, the liquidity doesn't tell you anything about that. The timing of payments, you don't know. The market risk, you don't know. The two may have the same thing and they offset. But what was compelling to me to prefer one versus three or 3A was your example of the $1.1 billion and the billion versus the $200 million and the $100 million. And where I came out on that had nothing to do with the arguments in the paper. Where I came out was these two entities are hugely different. And by netting them, they look to be the same. And so it has nothing to do with, you might be right, the $1.1 billion versus the billion, they may have the exact same equity instruments offsetting, so there's no market risk. But I don't know that. The payments may be coming around the same time, so there's not a lot of liquidity. But I don't know that. It could be hugely different. And so it just seems to me we're making something that is very, very different look the same. And so when I think of one, clearly at the end of the day, if there's a difference, that's shown. Clearly at the end of the day, the growth shows you the magnitude, the potential for the change the next day. I just think it's better information. So that's where I came out. I thought master netting was okay when we did this before, but the more I think about it, I'm for alternative one.
Thank you. Tom?
I'm from alternative one or two, and where I differ with Russ is the example that he talked about, the 100 long derivative, the 70 short derivative, and I don't care about collateral. I mean, collateral is the difference between 3 and 3A, but the starting point on both 3 and 3A is that what's owed is net of 30. And that's not true until bankruptcy, when someone elects the option to take the default option. So the cash flows that will be required, whether it's 1 year from now or 3 days from now, the cash flows that will be required is one party's going to receive 100 and the other's going to pay 70. And because that's the ongoing nature of the business, I don't see representing 100 minus 70 is equal 30 at this point until you get to the default circumstance or the counterparty actually takes the option And then you're in a master netting, and I show 30. And if there's collateral, zero. But the big difference between, the big difference for me is, not collateral, not the 30, there's two sets of cash flows going on in normal course of business, and I think we should show those growths.
I am still in alternative three, and I just remind everybody that it's in, I accept the basic principle that's laid out here for most financial assets and liabilities, but I would support an exception for derivatives, and I would just want to explain why. I view derivatives as a unique kind of instrument where there can be cash inflows and outflows due in the same contractual arrangement. We have both decided that those instruments should be reported at fair value, which is implicitly a net amount on the balance sheet. There really aren't other arrangements like that other than insurance, where we're also going with a net approach to those. And in insurance, you're involving multiple counterparties, but I'll try not to digress. When you then relate separate derivative transactions through a master netting agreement, I do believe, based on the legal advice that we have gotten over the years in the United States, that those have the effect of merging the contractual rights on those arrangements. So it's really just an extension of the original principle, which is when you have cash inflows and outflows in the same contractual arrangement that's being carried at fair value, you report that net. And so I think that when the parties have undertaken those deliberate arrangements to link the contractual cash flows for the primary reason of mitigating their credit risk, that the best representation of them is to show them net on the balance sheet. With respect to the concerns that have been raised about whether that is an appropriate indication of risk, I view this as just an extension of the logic that you use on a single derivative contract that has inbound and outbound cash flows. We do not go into those contracts and report the gross present value of the cash inflows and the gross present value of the cash outflows. So even if we just have this conversation in the context of a single derivative contract, I simply don't think that you can get the information that you need about exposure to risk or even liquidity by looking at just the amount of the fair value of a derivative on the balance sheet. And so I absolutely believe you need robust information in the footnotes to provide the whole picture about derivatives and about derivatives that are subject to netting arrangements. I am a little bit concerned about the emphasis on payment netting in the alternative approach in the following sense. When you think about long-term derivative contracts, there's a series of interim cash flows that are made, you know, that are stipulated by the parties to, for example, settle coupons, et cetera. This, as I understand the staff recommendation, would say as long as you've set up your arrangements to have payment netting of the cash flows as they become due, you would then net the whole instruments that these cash flows relate to. And so, if I take my portfolios of derivative contracts that are set up to have payment netting, I might have the individual cash flows being settled net as they come due, but then I've got the balance of the fair value of the arrangement that is yet to be collected. And I don't really understand why this focus on payment netting of the cash flows as they come due gives you great comfort then that it's okay to net the fair value of those instruments and then have the same issues that have been discussed with respect to the master netting agreements. I was persuaded by the presentation we had last week, primarily by the attorneys in the group, that were talking about how when they think about setting up these arrangements, their focus is they only care about what happens in the event of a default of one of the parties. In other words, you can set these contracts up to have payment netting and everybody's humming along, but when somebody defaults, what you care about is the cash flows yet to occur. And that is the significance of these arrangements, whether you're talking about on a master netting agreement or whether you're talking about on a clearing system. I'm concerned about the emphasis on collateral as well. We at the FASB just rescinded a piece of GAAP where collateral had the effect of changing whether you accounted for something as a sale or a borrowing, and that was an issue in the Lehman situation. We said, actually, the accounting should not matter depending on whether you've posted collateral or not. So I would not want to move forward with an approach that would have the accounting hinge on whether you've posted collateral or not. And to Christian's question about why should collateral matter in these cases, I'm not contradicting what I just said, but just to explain, I think the reason parties are posting collateral in these arrangements and leaving it there as opposed to using it to settle the contract is because tomorrow the value is going to change. So the collateral may need to go back, and it's just a convenience, I believe, to have it able to go back and forth expeditiously. So for those reasons, we've had this exception in U.S. GAAP for over 10 years now. I've never in all that time heard concerns raised about it reporting misleading information. We've expanded the disclosure package to provide the information I think people want about the gross amounts for volume purposes and an indication of what questions to ask about risk. And with that full package, I think you've got what you need in the area of derivatives.
Leslie. Larry.
So, Leslie, let me ask you a question so that I can understand it better, because I've struggled with this considerably. My interpretation of what you said was that effectively you view the master netting agreement as a vehicle through which different derivatives have effectively been combined into one like derivative instrument, because that's the only way that I can understand it. Am I right?
Yes. In other words, some people view it as the master netting agreement is the primary contract, and then you're changing, by doing transactions every day, you're changing the net cash flows that are owed and due between those two counterparties. But clearly, each of the transactions has substance in itself. It's just a question of the best way to report it.
Okay. Because, I mean, like I said, I've struggled. You know, I went to my older brother, John, before and asked him what his views were. And I totally agree with him that whether you present these things gross or net, ultimately you lack information. It doesn't matter. You don't know what the cash flow characteristics are unless someone, you know, gives you those details, et cetera. But yet, fundamentally, if you have 199 versus 10,000 and 9,099, there's a considerable difference in what those two entities are about and what they're transacting in. And I just struggle to say that the balance sheet shouldn't reflect those differences. While I listened hard and I heard what Isda said, and there were times when I thought I was flipping over, I'm having a hard time saying that you should not account for those differently and show the segregation.
Sorry. Al?
Like Larry and several others, I've really struggled with this, and I just recall every day I got my risk management reports internally, and the thickness of the reports and the details and the complexities of just assembling these reports, and we struggle with this internally with all the information available to us, and we struggled year after year after year with how to analyze it, how to capture it, and then convey it out to investors. So we dealt with this particular issue, and what I found was nothing on the balance sheet and nothing in disclosures that we've ever talked about will get you anywhere close to what the ultimate answer is. So I was, unlike Tom, I was left with collateral, and I appreciate Leslie's comments about other things that we've done. I was left with kind of 3A. I was maybe a little bit more reliant on the variation margin. So I just really had two questions, and the one was to Russ. Russ, you favored 3 over 3A. And so, two, the settlement on different dates, you were willing to accept that? And if so, why?
When you say two.
Two. It's scenario one, except for instruments settled on different dates. I struggled with that one.
Sorry, I didn't find
one. The reason for that is I think if we have an existing master netting arrangement and we're not requiring the posting of daily collateral, we've already made a judgment.
Already made that decision. Okay, I got it. And Tom, you on seven, which is really the only difference between 3A and one, you were fine with you thought it was important that trades settled separately. Or you couldn't accept that. Okay.
Because there's cash flows both those cash flows.
Okay. All right, and you ignored the variation margin in that particular situation.
So on different things.
Okay.
No, I'm not ignoring the variation margin. In the instance where I would do 100 versus the 70,
The 100 versus the 70, if 30 collateral was provided, if that 30 collateral was provided, I would put it against the 100, and I'd have 70 on one side and 70 on the other, as long as that 30 variation margin really was in a process that created settlement on the 100, I would use the variation margin. It wouldn't ignore it. I just wouldn't say that the starting point was a net 30 position.
Okay.
Any other points?
I just have one point on what John and Larry have said. I recognize, John, the way you teed it up is you're not viewing necessarily which one is better. You're having a difficult decision determining which one's better, but the reason we did all the expansive disclosures on derivative disclosures was we had the understanding you couldn't tell from looking at the face of the balance sheet. You're still going to have that problem here. Users have told us they're going to have to go in the notes to understand the underlying risk, to understand the liquidity. And in essence, that's where I'd want them to see the volume, not on the balance sheet, because it's all in one place. So I just... think about why we did derivative disclosures. Think about why it has to be in the footnotes and the balance sheet doesn't tell you that.
And so I agree. And that was part of the reason first go around. It just seemed to me balance sheet notes, it doesn't matter. And even when you look at both, you need more information. I accept that. Here's where I came out. And it was the example more than anything else. I don't want to have to go looking in the notes to find out that this has got significant volume of derivatives. And I think if it's on the balance sheet, I'm going to say, wow, I want to ask questions. And that would lead me to, and I'd accept there was a comment, you know, this does not show the market risk because maybe it's offset. But I don't know that. So I just look at it, and it's the thing that kind of threw me over. I said, these two entities are very different. Right away on a balance sheet, when I compare them, I'm going to ask questions about this guy. So that's kind of where I came out.
And I agree with everything that John just said. And what I didn't say before, but I'll say it now, is I don't feel comfortable making a decision as to how to present something on the balance sheet based upon what will happen in bankruptcy. I don't think that's a good way to evaluate the appropriate accounting for a company in a going concern.
Tom?
Christian, I'd like to go back for one moment to the question that Paul asked about what happens in scenario 7 and 8. And you say 7, you are not at risk, but the next day you are at risk because there will be a settlement of the variation margin. And Paul asked, but what if you have a deposit with the clearinghouse which protects you against the risk on that variation margin? And you say, well, it depends on the volume. But if you have sufficient posting of the different participants to protect the payment of the variation margins, then we'll be okay to say, for scenario 7, in that case, it's yes rather than no, which is alternative 3A.
I think entities do differ, and derivative portfolios will be different from one relationship to the other. You might have some collateral or some initial margin or independent amount which is against a counterparty going bankrupt. But that might not be anywhere near the amount you need when your counterparty goes bankrupt. It is difficult to know from today whether the amount is going to be sufficient or not. It is impossible to know.
And those amounts are used, our understanding is the initial margin, the independent amounts, are only used for bankruptcy or default, so they're not used in the normal settlement process.
Your answer is, in theory, yes, but practically we don't know whether it's sufficient. So it's not a conceptual analysis. It's provided, we could say, provided there is certainty that there is enough collateral to protect the variation margin, it would be okay, but because you can't prove it, forget it.
Yeah, I think the problem is you don't know which. They've told us they cannot forecast into the future to know how much they have to pay or receive on the various instruments going forward. And hence, the entities themselves, by their assertion, cannot claim that they know the initial margin will be enough to cover any potential payments. So from today, I don't think anybody can convince me that they can do that, because by their own assertion, they're saying that we don't know, we cannot forecast the cash flows into the future. And hence, how would you know how much you have to pay out, whether the individual, the independent amount or the initial margin will be sufficient to cover your exposures going forward? It only covers for changes in fair value on a day-to-day basis.
Okay, I must admit I'm in John and Larry's and Tom's camp too. I just find the sheer volume of the thing does give you a completely different picture, just rather than just net it down, and I'm not sure I want to go to the notes for that.
Do people appreciate that if you then put these on a clearing system that meets all of these requirements, you will have zero on the balance sheet and you will have no indication of the volume of trades and the risk of the entity that are occurring?
I don't know if the risks are the same.
The clearing is a natural, if it meets the conditions, is tantamount to a settlement.
It's a settlement. Of that payment that has just been made, not of the remaining fair value of the item.
Not any changes in fair value, but the net amount, through this clearing, such as swap clear, the way we understand it is the net amount is accumulated with discounted future payments, so assuming no changes in fair value other than payments, that would actually be settling all future cash flows. So some of it's almost like a prepayment of future amounts. Because I agree with you, there needs to be a substantial difference for us to get a different result.
I think to add to what Barbara said, the way, if you meet this particular principle, it works as if you have a futures market. When you have a futures market and you're paying all the changes in fair value, the contracts are more or less reset on a daily basis. And hence, you don't have all the accumulated fair value. All you have is the change in fair value yesterday. And hence, when you meet this principle, you come to more or less the same scenario. And hence, it doesn't really matter because you've more or less settled everything that you have to settle. And what you have left is what you've not settled yet. Which is, it gives you a good reflection of where you are.
Hans?
Just two general comments. 2 months ago, during an IOSCO conference, I listened to a very lengthy lecture by one of the principal designers of the master netting agreement. And he told the audience about all the complications in the enforcement of derivatives and the netting of such. And he, for that reason, pleaded for a world court to be established to settle these disputes. Then I said, after the conference, I asked him the question, given all these legal complications, surely you must be against the netting of these contracts on the balance sheet. And then I got an extremely lengthy and unclear answer. And that was a quite clear indication for me that there was something probably fishy going on. Secondly, I'm also convinced by the same argument that John Smith just used, that what was never clear to me, but a lot of derivatives are being netted or offset that are very different in nature, and they are heterogeneous, which means necessarily that the net of these derivatives can change hugely overnight as a result of fair value movements of these very derivatives. So the net gives a very poor indication of the real risks that are being run, especially since we're not talking about 5% of the balance sheet. We're talking about, on the average, 30% of the balance sheet. Enormous amounts that can result in huge swings in net positions. So it would seem to me doubtful that we should relegate 30% of the balance sheet to footnotes, and especially after all the off-balance sheet problems that we've had in the last couple of decades, and also during the financial crisis.
Okay, any other comments? Okay, Holly?
I just wanted to make one point of clarification just so that everybody understands. There are a lot of different things that we hear about with respect to legal implications associated with master netting agreements, but we've heard over and over and over again from the legal experts that with respect to master netting agreements, closeout netting, which is the piece that we're focused on, it is held up. It is held up in the jurisdictions that they've sought the legal assurance for. It's never been questioned. It's only some of the other aspects of the master netting agreement when it relates to mutual suspense and some other aspects of it that it comes into question. But the closeout netting feature of the master netting agreement to which we're so focused on, that holds up. So it could be that your discussion was focused on some of the other issues that they are evaluating with respect to litigation, but it does not relate to closeout netting.
And can I just add one thing to that? I think that the important thing is, and I know there's differing views on the enforceability arguments, and I think that, they are, the closeout type provisions are certainly robust in the main jurisdictions. I think that's a fair point. But I think the important thing is that most of the issues that everybody has raised that they're using as their basis for their arguments actually aren't focused primarily on the enforceability of master netting arrangements at all. So I think we should put that discussion in context, given some questions that have been raised on some of the points we've made on enforceability.
It has nothing to do with my views.
Is anybody's view affected by the enforceability of the legal situation? Okay. Well, can I then put the question, the recommendation, Christian, is alternative one. Is that right? I thought that was the recommendation. Well, I'll take it in order that way, just work along then. Could I ask ISB first, those in favour of alternative one? Okay, FASB, those in favour of one?
One, two, three.
Okay, shall I try three? I just want to find out where FASB is. Method alternative 3A, or I better do two first, it's the next one. Those in favour of two, FASB only? Nobody? 3A? One. And three?
One,
three.
Two, three.
Okay. Now we can do Hal.
Hal, are you interested in considering three or?
Three.
Okay. As opposed to one. Yeah. Okay. So we would have four for three.
Right. That's why I asked the question earlier
about what. Yeah. Okay. We're going to have to obviously think how we handle this. One way may be that we have to go a different way if we can't agree, because we're pretty decisive in one direction. And it may be then we have to have disclosures so that people can actually walk from one to the other. Yes, sure, John.
And I know you don't want me bringing this up, but at the round table I went to at the FASB, I had asked a question about this linkage and about the linkage. I don't know if you remember the question about, okay, if I'm just thinking, if we're not agreeing, could we, at least for the derivatives bit, under the master netting, gross that up and show it together in the balance sheet? And the reason I'm throwing it out now, when I asked the question, I asked a preparer a regulator and a user whether that's something they could accept, and they all said yes. So here we are, we're apart. Clearly the world's telling us to get together. From my point of view, and it's the point of view I was trying to express here, having it on the balance sheet and seeing the trigger there is key, and this would do that. So I don't know whether that's worth exploring or not. I know you guys don't like that, but I'm looking at if there's a way to get together.
Well, we'd certainly, if we do that, need a paper on it rather than do it on the fly here, because you then have the question of, do we do that for non-recourse finance as well? We've just said in our pension standard that we don't believe in it. We've actually said that in
it. I would limit it to the... Right, not on the fly. I'm just trying to see if there's a way to...
That's right, the Korean hedging issue too. So there's
But I would say derivatives, master netting meets all those conditions of 3 or 3A, whatever. Show those linked.
Yeah, just a second. Okay, well, I'll come around. We have to be, watch the time, make it very quick.
I think disclosure is important. I think we had agreement across the board in the exposure draft. If we're going to get bogged down on link presentations, others, I would encourage us to at least finish the disclosure improvement as soon as we can, because I think that will be beneficial to investors.
Okay, Paul.
I want to say one word for the poor, forgotten conceptual framework and the definition of an asset and a liability. I think that's what we're trying to put on the balance sheet. We've got to decide, do we have assets, do we have liabilities, or do we have some net risk position? If we got assets and liabilities, that ought to be on the balance sheet.
And I'm glad you let me go after Paul, because what I was going to say is that I ordinarily wouldn't entertain linkage, but John's recommendation to do derivatives, I think I could live with, because they can be an asset one day and a liability the next, in answer to Paul. So does it really make a difference if we put them together? Because they're going to bounce back and forth anyway.
Well, we've got three alternatives, really. One is a pure disclosure approach, where we just go from one to the other if you can. The second is the linkage. And the third is, can we coalesce on 3A with disclosure? Now, Russ said he could vote for that. Now, is the question, could those who went for one go for that? Now, that's what we have to ask. Could I just get a feel, ISP, if we could just see where you would stand? Who would, I presume nobody would disagree with the disclosure if we had to do that. So we're really, okay. So what about, who would like to explore a linkage approach for derivatives?
In lieu of what?
Yes, in lieu of one, yeah. Who would like to explore that?
Two.
It's a lieu of one. It'll have to be different.
You'd still do one, but you'd layer on that for derivatives.
So instead of one.
One is great.
Who would like to go with that? Could I see that just two?
Two.
Under the asset.
Okay. And then what about 3A? That's the big difference is item 7, which was Steve's first question. And that is the only difference between one that we've got in this chart. And do we do something on the disclosures on item 7?
Can I just check this in? That is actually the biggest bucket in terms of derivatives. So it might be one item, but it's the biggest bucket.
Okay, who would think about looking at that in ISB? Yeah, I'm asking ISB, who would sort of look at that?
One, two.
I mean, we're trying to get together here. So I'm willing to look at anything.
I could live with it.
What are we talking about?
Well, it's a possible.
It's a little bit more polarized.
A little fluid. I don't want it.
Okay. Christian, is that as far as we go today?
Yeah, I think that's probably as far as we can go. But I just wanted to remind the board that it appears that majority of users saying, well, we want both. And so to the extent that you go separate ways, if you give our disclosures that you can work your way back from one to the other, I think that will make a lot of users happy. So it might not be a bad place to land.
Yeah.
Can I ask who on the FASB would be willing to pursue a linked approach? In other words, have some sort of a gross up on the balance sheet, but then net down to a net position. I'm just curious if that's an alternative for us to do. No?
Okay.
I don't feel personal.
Okay, well, we have to then get disclosure so we can actually go from one to the other, as well as the general disclosures. Okay, can we stop at that stage? We'll have a short session on insurance. We're going to have an admin session.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Holly.
Thanks, FASB.
I don't know. Just asking.
Presentation. It's not short. But how long do we need for that?
Okay.
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 Okay. Just a second. It's going to be too long, is it? So it's going to take an hour or so, is it? Can't do it. No, we've got to do admin. Yeah. Okay.
Andrea?
So we'll just stop there then. Just bring the presentation back next month.
Unless we somehow free it tomorrow, are we
going to
lose any of the
options?
We have an hour and a half for us tomorrow.
Well, yeah, we do. There's a lot we needed.
I thought it was alternative one. We don't.